Today's show is brought to you by Underbrush, a new thriller by Kevin Carr. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, we're going to be talking about some new films and some old films that have kind of been popping up after Christmas for bigger releases. We're going to be talking about Taken 3, Inherent Vice, and Selma. We're also going to be talking about some news, particularly my thoughts on the Charlie Hebdo attack and on the fact that Hollywood revenue is down 5% in 2014. We're also going to talk the trailer park, the box office predictions, and the world-famous DVD roundup. But before we get to all that, I do want to give a big fat guy welcome to News Talk 560 KWTO in Springfield, Missouri. Thank you for bringing the show on the station, and we hope to fill your ears with listening pleasure for many years to come. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies, or you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
That's right, Ron Burgundy. I'm going to be talking a lot about the Charlie Hebdo attack. But before we get into that pretty heavy discussion, I wanted to remind everybody to watch the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, which is going to be broadcast live on A&E on January 15th at 9 p.m. The reason it's important is because I actually vote in these, and I have a say in the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, so you can check that out. Now that we've got that out of the way, let's talk about something a little more serious. This is, of course, the big story that's currently developing, you know, through the weekend. And what happened was earlier this week, there was a terror attack on the French satirical magazine, Charlie Hebdo. Gunmen burst into the place and they killed 12 people, injured almost the same amount, four of them critically injured, and then left in manhunt going for them. I'm not really going to be talking about the specifics of the attack and the global politics around it right now. I just want to give my thoughts on the side of it from the free speech angle, from entertainment and satire and parody, which is what I am more a part of. Global politics, that's for other people to talk about. But if I'm going to be talking about the censoring of art and the censoring of satire, to start off, if you're not familiar with Charlie Hebdo, which I wasn't before this event, it's a French magazine. It's heavily satirical. It's extremely liberal, and there is no sacred cow. It will make fun of everybody, including the Prophet Muhammad, which is what precipitated the attack to happen. They strike out against major religions all over. They strike against Christianity and Judaism and politics and the interbreeding of those and as they see it. It's a very bold magazine, and it pulls no punches. And it has been, in fact, the subject of terror attacks before. There was a firebombing of the offices a couple years ago and other threats. So the threat of retaliation was nothing new. But it finally did happen, and 12 people died, which is a horrible, horrible thing. One of the things that I've seen starting to happen is people have been publishing some of the covers that, of course, were the most inflammatory covers of their magazines, and the art and the cartoons that were in there that were ticking off the extremist Muslims groups. And there are some places that aren't publishing those covers. Some of them might be saying it's because they're sometimes very crass or sexually explicit, but there's also a hint that people aren't publishing because they don't want this to happen to them. And that's part of the problem. If you're going to show pictures of people getting killed, and you're going to show pictures of soldiers being, their dead bodies being dragged through the square, you should publish these. Because this is part of the news. And it's irresponsible for a media outlet to not address these and not hold them up and say, this is what it was about. Because by not doing that, you're giving in, and that's a bad thing. This reminds me a lot of that South Park episode in which they depicted the Prophet Muhammad, and they're going to show him, and it caused a big to-do. And there were threats against Comedy Central, and Comedy Central censored South Park because they were afraid they were going to get bombed or attacked. That is the worst thing you can do, because you're giving in, like Sony pulling the interview from theaters. You literally are saying, oh, you're going to threaten it? We will pull away. We're going to flinch. We're going to back down. And I know it's scary, but this is where the rubber meets the road. Now, what's happened with the Comedy Central thing a couple years back is that led to the Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. Because the whole point is that you're not supposed to depict Muhammad in art or pictures. And then, of course, the cartoons in Charlie Hebdo were extremely inflammatory pictures, depictions of Muhammad doing sexual acts and very offensive stuff. And while it's offensive, that's something that's necessary to happen. Yes, things are offensive, but offensive things have to be seen and they have to exist. And if you're offended, don't look at them, but don't censor them. When the Comedy Central thing led to the Everybody Draw Muhammad Day, there were a lot of racist things. And that's one of the concerns that people have, that there's going to be a racist backlash against Muslims in general, in particular French Muslims. And here's the thing. This is not an anti-Islam thing. Freedom of expression is what it's about. And yes, sometimes freedom of expression is going to be inappropriate and racist and wrong. But that does not mean it should be destroyed or put away. It should exist, and if people are offended and don't want it, they don't have to experience it. But the threat of violence against that is wrong. If you're offended by this stuff, get over it. This isn't about respect. This is about violence that's threatened for something that previously wasn't a big deal. Remember Larry Flint? Decades ago, I mean, the guy's a jerk. He's a horrible person. But his parody and the satire that happened in Hustler magazine, as crass as it was and still does happen in the magazine, it's important to let it be there and not be stifled. You should not have any, either government or groups, threatening violence and then getting that shut down. Giving up is not the answer. These cartoons need to be shown and people need to see them. And if you're offended and you think they're gross, fine. But they exist and they should be allowed to exist. And if everybody's doing it, the target is so broad that nobody can become a viable target. Make no mistakes, the people who died in the Charlie Hebdo attack, they're heroes because they were exercising their rights and it got them killed for it. Now, it's a terrible thing, but it proves the cliche of how mighty the pen really is. This was their weapon in the war against freedom, and we should honor them as much as we honor fallen heroes in battle. And if you don't like the sensibilities on them, it doesn't matter. Just as you don't have to agree with the personal politics of a soldier who shot defending your freedom. This is a horrible act, and it should be treated as such. And we don't need to be blaming the people who drew these images. You need to be blaming the people who are trying to stifle that. Because free speech is free speech. And if you don't like it, you don't have to experience it. But you should not be able to suppress it with government intrusion or the threat of violence. And that sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Real quick, we're just going to do one this week. And it's the big one. It's Ant-Man. The Ant-Man trailer premiered on the TV show Agent Carter this week, and you finally have it as a full trailer for the movie starring Paul Rudd, the next installment in the Marvel mega hit franchise.
Second chances don't come around all that often. I suggest you take a really close look at it. Scott, I need you to be the Ant-Man.
One question. Is it too late to change the name?
The trailer doesn't do much justice from an audio level because it's a teaser. Just you've seen a lot of action, people getting beat up and hit. But I think what it does show is it shows the sarcastic attitude of Ant-Man, and it shows that Paul Rudd is taking control of that. It feels somewhat in line with something like a Captain America movie. It's out there and crazy because it's got this guy who can shrink down to bug size, but it's not so far out there that it's almost like the Avengers or Guardians of the Galaxy. It looks like it could be good. It opens on July 17th, which is right in the the height of summer movie season. This is the time that Dark Knight opened. It's not going to be as big, but hopefully this will be good. I'd like to see this as a more of a smaller Thor level, Captain America level Marvel movie. And I mean, they don't need to have a huge hit this summer because they've already got the Avengers 2 coming in May. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Liam Neeson in Taken 3 and Inherit Vice. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys in the Movies, rolling into the movie review segments. Let's talk about the new films for the week, starting off with Taken 3. Do we need a synopsis for this one? I mean, why do they keep taking Liam Neeson's stuff? When will they stop? It should know by now. You don't take this guy's parking space, let alone mess with his family. And let me tell you this, if Liam Neeson is getting on the phone with you, that is a bad thing. Because these movies are all about him kicking butt and threatening people on the phone. Anyways, Taken 3. People just taking his stuff. When are they going to stop?
Wanted for murder. Suspect's name, Brian Mills.
21, he joins the army. At 23, he joins the special forces. He's a trained sniper. An explosives expert. No service record, no discharge record, nothing. This guy right here, he knows how to disappear.
Listen carefully, Kim. Something terrible's happened to your mom.
Dad, what's going on?
Don't trust anyone.
I am a huge fan of the first two Takens. I remember seeing the first one and kind of being blown away and surprised at how fun and different it was. And what's interesting about the series is it's produced and written by, especially initially, by Luc Besson, who's a pretty strong French director. I don't like all of his stuff. Besson directed that movie, The Family, with Michelle Pfeiffer and Robert De Niro, I don't know, what, about a year and a half? So, I mean, I didn't particularly like that, and I kind of blow hot and cold with Besson's stuff, but the guy knows action, and the guy knows how to do that really punchy European-based action thriller. And that's certainly what the first Taken was. Taken, no pun intended, took everybody by surprise, and it was a great thriller, it was a great action movie, and it really was the first one that galvanized Liam Neeson as a viable box office action star. Now, Taken 2 came out a couple years ago, and I still thought Taken 2 was fun. I mean, it was pretty much kind of a rehash of the same thing, and instead of chasing his daughter down, he was using her help to try and find his wife who had been kidnapped and injured. But it still worked. I mean, it was definitely wholly a Taken movie. It still felt like that, and it still felt like it had a story that made sense. This one stumbles a bit. And the reason it stumbles a bit, honestly, the biggest problem it has is it all takes place in L.A. And not to be somebody who sounds all hoity-toity and be like, oh, well, it's in Europe, so that must mean it's better. Not that the setting makes it any more esoteric or better or smarter. It's just with the European setting that they had in the first two films, it felt like a solid Luc Besson thriller. It had that feel to it. It had that punch to it. There's something about the international locations that made it work. It's kind of like James Bond. You're watching a James Bond movie. The James Bond movies that take place primarily in the United States kind of are the duds. By moving it to L.A., instead of, where were they, in Istanbul in the second movie, and they were in all over Europe, but in France in the first movie. What made it unique and different and exciting is just, it just turns into every other film about cops in L.A. and you know, somebody action film in L.A. It didn't feel different, and it has all the same people behind it. I mean, it's got Liam Neeson and Femke Janssen and Maggie Grace. They're all back for this movie, and you've got Oliver Megaton, which is still the greatest name ever, and he's directing it, and you've got Luc Besson behind it, at least from a producing level. But it loses its punch by just throwing it in L.A., and on top of it, they get in Forrest Whitaker to play the FBI agent or the cop who's going after him to try because he's been framed for murder. And we've seen Forrest Whitaker play this role a dozen times. I mean, no, he's not Idi Amin, but we saw in The Last Stand, he's the exact same character he was in The Last Stand, which was the Schwarzenegger film from a couple years ago, or what he played a version of this character in The Shield back on TV. It's just so standard at this point. It took all of its uniqueness away and just became every other movie that gets released on direct to video or video on demand that doesn't warrant a theatrical release. So it just, what was a fun franchise just sort of got averaged out. So ultimately, I have to say Taken 3 kind of sucks. I was disappointed. I was looking forward to it, but it kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Inherent Vice. Paul Thomas Anderson directs an ensemble piece about a 1970s private detective on the search for his ex-girlfriend's boyfriend.
If it's a quiet night out at the beach and your ex-old lady suddenly out of nowhere shows up with a story about her current billionaire land developer boyfriend and his wife and her boyfriend and a plot to kidnap the billionaire and throw him in a loony bin.
I need your help, Doc.
Maybe you should just look the other way. But if you're Doc, it may all start to get a little peculiar after that.
Michael Z. Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
And Mickey Wolfman.
Has vanished.
And a girl don't necessarily want to get into difficulties with those folks.
This one is one of those movies that came out right at Christmas in like New York and LA for a very short run, just in a couple theaters, just to be eligible for award consideration. To most of the country, it opens this week, but it technically came out in December. I didn't cover it then because like 58 movies came out right at Christmas and we needed to stretch it out. Plus, most people aren't going to have a chance to see this movie until now. Inherent Vice is directed by P.T. Anderson, and I liked P.T. Anderson's earlier stuff. I mean, Boogie Nights, I think, is a brilliant, brilliant movie. It's still, I don't think he's reached the level of complexity that he has. Now, a lot of people will disagree with me, but I've kind of been a little bit cold to some of his more recent serious efforts. The Master was a very interesting movie, but it didn't knock me over. I thought it was well done, and it was a good movie, but it wasn't great. And same thing with There Will Be Blood. I wasn't terribly jazzed by There Will Be Blood. I mean, again, good movie, but it wasn't an amazing film for me. That's kind of the feeling I have with Inherent Vice. There's some parts of it that are brilliant and amazing, and it has some elements that if you take on its own, it makes a lot of sense and it's really good. But there's other elements to the movie as a whole that just don't make sense. And I, because I'm a critic and because I'm in several voting organizations, and like I said, I vote in the Critics' Choice Movie Awards, and we were sent these things so we can nominate them before they're released. And I live in Columbus, Ohio, so I don't have the luxury of going to see it in New York. They'll send us screeners at the end of the year. And so I'd seen this actually about a month ago, and I put it in one night, and my wife and I were at home, and I start watching it. And as you tend to do sometimes with a movie that you're watching at home, you maybe have your computer open and you'll see an email come in and you'll check it or you'll look at Twitter or Facebook, but you're paying attention to the movie. We got about half hour into this film. And I look over at my wife and I said, "Do you know what's going on?" And she looks at me and she's like, "Not really." And I'm like, "Huh." And I thought, well, maybe it's because I got distracted. Maybe I went onto Twitter or I went onto Facebook and maybe I was checking emails and I kind of got distracted. So I went back and rewatched the first half hour of the movie and then continued it. It still didn't make sense to me. And maybe I'm dumb. That could be it. I could be just a big fat idiot. But it just, I didn't get it. There's a lot of stuff going on. I described it to a critic friend of mine the other night as it's like a sneeze. There's a lot of stuff flying around that you really don't need to pay attention to. It has some fantastic performances. I mean, Josh Brolin's brilliant in it, and Joaquin Phoenix is very funny in it, but it's so hard to follow because they put so much plot in there that is completely pointless and irrelevant to the film. This is the kind of movie that, for P.T. Anderson fans, you probably are going to love it, but you have to be a fan. You have to have liked everything he's done. If you don't, don't go in looking at this ensemble cast and be like, "Oh, it's Owen Wilson from Wedding Crashers. This should be good." Yeah, Owen Wilson's in it, but it certainly ain't Wedding Crashers. And as much as I appreciate what P.T. Anderson's doing, I just couldn't get into the movie. So for me, Inherent Vice kind of sucks. Sorry, P.T. Anderson.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
That's it for those movies. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Selma and Blue Ruin. Kevin Carr crushing it with Fat Guys at the Movies. When I say crushing it, I think I sound like my dad when he says, oh, you're a really cool dude. I mean, my dad's like in his 70s. He was born in the 30s, and he is not now, nor has he ever been a cool dude. I love him, but he is about the biggest nerd on the planet. So him trying to talk cool is really ridiculous. And so me saying crushing it, I think, is that's my honor to him, I guess you can say. While I'm crushing it in the movie review segments, let's talk about one of the other movies that's getting a wider release this week. It opened very, very limited right before Christmas. Of course, the rumors were that it wasn't even finished. I mean, they'd like finished it in middle of December and got it out there for screenings. And that would be Selma. The days of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s civil rights struggles in Selma, Alabama are examined in this contained biopic.
Mr. President, in the South, there have been thousands of racially motivated murders.
We need your help,
Dr. King. This thing's just going to have to wait.
It cannot wait.
You got one big issue, I got 101.
Summer it is.
We'll not tolerate agitators attempting to orchestrate a disturbance in this state.
It is unacceptable that they use their power to keep us voiceless. Those that have gone before us say no more.
Now, I say in that description it's a biopic. It is because it plays like one. It shows true events. It shows his background. It shows his personal life. But it's not a biopic that, say, something like, you know, Malcolm X was, which is a 3.5-4-hour movie. Goes all the way back to when he was a kid as he grows up and the many stages of his life all the way up to his assassination. This is just his moment in Selma. It's much more contained, which I think is good. Part of the problem with biopics is they try to cover everything because they're trying to cover somebody's entire life. Like Joaquin Phoenix in The Walk the Line. I mean, you're going through his entire, Johnny Cash's entire life from kid to playing Folsom Prison. This is really just Martin Luther King's impact in Selma, which is one of his biggest achievements. And I got to just say, it's a fantastic movie. Now, I know it's getting criticized because of historical accuracy. Anytime you have any sort of historical film or biopic or any sort of based on a true story, you have to take liberties with it. It never ceases to annoy me when people complain, well, that's not exactly what happened, or you left this out, or this thing that I think is really important about the story was not represented in the movie. It's a movie. I mean, Selma's like 2 hours long. You can't get everything in there. So nitpicking based on what isn't there, I mean, unless it's like ridiculously over the top. Like if they show Martin Luther King doing stuff he obviously didn't do. If they have a scene where he would go to a Klan rally and use jujitsu to wipe out the Klan in the area, that would be a little ridiculous because he did not do that. But ultimately, as a historical drama, Selma is a great film. It really, really is. It has a fantastic performance in the lead role by, and I know I'm going to butcher his name. I apologize in advance. David Oyelowo. He does a fantastic job in it. But on top of it, Ava DuVernay, who is the director, she does a fantastic job with it too. It's a very even-keeled, deliberate movie. Reminds me a bit of Clint Eastwood's directing style, which is good. We need more of that because nowadays, because of technology and cinematography techniques, everything gets very herky-jerky and thrown around. And while that is exciting at some times, it gets a little bit old. And DuVernay's approach to the film is very somber. Almost, it's very Martin Luther King. The approach to the film is very much like the presence of Dr. Martin Luther King. He's very deliberate. He's a very careful speaker. And he was about poise and appearance. And that's what this movie gives. And it shows some pretty awful things. But these are some real awful things that did happen. And they're not that long ago, too. That's the thing I think that's most important to a movie like this. I was born in 1971. So I was born just a couple years after this took place. And it's kind of mind-boggling to think that this is how the world was, at least in certain areas of this country. And that's not a good thing. It's one of those movies that makes you realize the cliche that if you forget the past, you're doomed to repeat it. We need to remember this stuff. This is important. And there's civil rights struggles continuing to happen today. And you can't watch this movie in a vacuum, and it was not made in a vacuum. I think it's extremely relevant to some of the stuff that's going on. It's extremely relevant to what's happening just on your calendar. I mean, next weekend, we celebrate the observed birthday of Martin Luther King. So, I mean, it's timed out really well. Honestly, I'm going on the record now to say this is the one to beat at the Oscars. I know everyone's saying Boyhood or Birdman or even Grand Budapest Hotel, which was one of my favorite movies of the year. But Selma's the one to beat. Selma's the one to beat. It's going to gain steam fast over the next couple weeks. So watch out for this one. Selma rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's move on to a new feature I'm starting on the show. This is listener recommendations. I realize that there are some movies that I've just not seen. I see 500 to 600 movies a year. Some of them are repeats. But, I mean, I see literally hundreds of movies each year. Hundreds of first-time viewing of movies a year. Yet, I still miss a lot of films, even by the end of the year. And I want to give a venue, because I've had listeners and people who read my reviews say, hey, what about this movie? Have you seen this? And I'll be like, no. Why? I don't know. I just haven't gotten around to it. And there's some pretty significant movies I've never seen. You know, I've never seen Saving Private Ryan, for example. That's just one that I've never had a chance to see. I never saw it when it came out, and it was one of those movies that if I was going to see it, I needed to be in the right mood, which would have been a rare thing because you want to hit, you're going to be watching a heavy drama, and two, you need to block out like 3.5 hours for it. So there's a lot of movies like that. I literally have I have Ben-Hur sitting on my shelf. I've never watched Ben-Hur. Why? Because it's like 5,000 hours long, and if I'm going to watch it, I want to take the time to watch it. I have a very busy home life and family life and work life, so it's sometimes hard to find the time. So what I have done is I've set up an email address, and it is recommend@fatguysatthemovies.com. recommend@fatguysatthemovies.com. If you want to get in touch with me, or you can get in touch with me on the various other ways, in Twitter, Facebook, or whatever, and say, hey, dummy, why don't you watch this movie? And let us know what you think. Now, if it's something I've already seen, I'm not going to then rewatch it. But if it's a movie I've never seen, especially if it's something I haven't, I'm sitting here literally looking at a stack of DVDs and Blu-rays, and there's The Bridge on the River Kwai, which I've never seen. I have the Blu-ray. I've just never sat down and watched it. So I'm going to take listener recommendations and let me know what they are, and hopefully I'll pick one out. And I'm not going to do it every week, but as it becomes necessary, I will watch one and give my response to it. And today's is Blue Ruin, which came out last year. A homeless man finds a new purpose of revenge when the man who killed his parents is released from prison.
If it were my family, I might do the same. I know this is personal. That's how you'll fail.
By my count, that's two of yours and two of mine. I don't know how this ends.
Now, this one, like I said, came out last year, and it was very, very much under the radar. Not a whole lot of people saw it. This movie is one of those movies that it's not what you initially think it's going to be. I'm not a fan of just misery porn. I'm not a fan of just seeing bad things happen to somebody. I'm not a fan of just home invasion torture movies, those kind of things. There needs to be a purpose behind it, whether it be humorous or screwball or it's going to be serious and a revenge or something like that. There needs to be something to it. This has a very interesting take because it challenges you to think what you would do in this situation. Because of the character, this guy, he kind of goes nuts and becomes a homeless man. And when he discovers this guy's out of prison, he goes after him. But there's a little bit more to it. And it's not just him trying to kill this person. It's not just this person trying to kill his whole family. It shows the intense and sometimes tangled ugliness of crime and how it can be forgiven or forgotten by some people, but not by others. It's an intense movie, and it keeps you guessing. I didn't know what was going to happen in it. I thought it did at the first half hour, But things changed, and that's a good thing. And there are times when it really leads up to, oh, this is going to happen, and they kind of take a different turn. It's a well-paced, very well-made movie, and it has a mixture of suspense and crime and drama all together. So it's a good movie. It's worth checking out. I'm going to say Blue Ruin rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
All right, I need to go to a break, and when I come back, I'm going to be talking about the additional news, the box office, and the world-famous DVD Roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr coming back with Fat Guys at the Movies. Finishing up the show, but no, do not leave just yet because we've got a couple more cool things to talk about. Some interesting things. A couple more, a little bit more about the news. Some more analysis of what's going on. And I want to lead it off with The Hollywood Reporter and box office reports were coming out and basically saying that the box office receipts are lower this year than previous years. 5%. And that's, of course, even taken into account the inflation. And 3D upcharges and IMAX upcharges. And of course, this is having people curious and wondering. And you know, financial people are saying, well, you know, is this a danger for the industry? Yes and no. This itself isn't a danger. There's actually another little bit that's a little bit of concern for the industry. But in terms of the specific revenue stream that Hollywood has, there are some very clear, obvious reasons why full-blown Hollywood revenue was down. And it has to do with the movies that were and were not released. First of all, there were a couple movies that were moved out of the 2014 schedule that were significant and that would have contributed a huge percentage to the box office relatively. For example, Universal had no tentpoles this year. Normally, each big studio, Universal, Disney, Fox, Paramount, Columbia, they all have their big tentpole releases. Those are the Avengers movies and Star Wars and superhero films. Those are the tentpoles. Those are the ones that are going to make the most money. One of Universal's most tried and true series recently has been the Fast and Furious series. And they were supposed to release Furious 7 this summer. But because Paul Walker died last Thanksgiving, it messed up their production schedule and had to push. And now it's going to a 2015 release date. So Universal did not have that giant movie on their slate. Ironically, Universal has seen some of the best returns this year because they've had smaller movies like Lucy that didn't cost a lot. They didn't make $500 million, but they made a lot on that return. But Universal didn't have the huge $300 million tentpole. They also didn't have a big animated film like last year they had, or the previous year in 2013, they had Despicable Me 2, and this year they have Minions coming up. So they didn't have that. And then if you look at Disney, you had something similar happen there where The Good Dinosaur, which was supposed to be the big Pixar movie for 2014, got moved to 2015. So consequently, this year you got two Pixar movies. You've got Inside Out and The Good Dinosaur in the 2015 slate, whereas one of them was in 2014. So you had a couple major releases move out of the year. And they didn't, and they may have been replaced by other movies, but nothing huge. Now, of course, this consequently means Disney's going to have a banner year because this year in 2015, they've got The Avengers 2, they've got Star Wars 7 coming out at the end of the year, and they got two Pixar movies. It's going to be huge box office numbers for Disney in 2015. And while they saw good numbers with stuff like The Guardians of the Galaxy, they didn't have a $600 million movie like Avengers or a $430 million movie like Iron Man 3. The other reason box office is down is you just happen to have a bunch of sequels that didn't perform as well in 2014. And they were sort of like from franchise rot and fatigue. Stuff like Transformers, which was a $1 billion movie when you consider its worldwide revenue, but it didn't even crack $300 million in the States, which is the first time a Transformers movie didn't do that. Yeah, the same thing happened with Mockingjay Part 1, isn't a $400 million movie. It's over $300 million. It's not. It's like 75% of what the other two Hunger Games movies were. And then on top of it, you got a bunch of movies that had an initial excitement, but just ended up not being the great movies that they could have been. Stuff like Amazing Spider-Man 2 and Godzilla. So you've had a couple, not duds, but not ones that have clicked. You didn't have any of them that were big hits. That's why the revenue's down. Theater attendance is also down. Now, that's the thing that theaters are going to worry about, because we're down to a 19-year low for ticket sales, people going to the theater. And that is simply because of home video. The home video environment is much easier to attain the theatrical level now than it was even 5 years ago. You can get a 70-inch television and a Blu-ray player and surround sound for a reasonable amount of money for, you know, a couple grand. You can get a 40-inch TV with a Blu-ray player for probably less than $700 nowadays. It's pretty easy to get a really nice home system that you did not have 10 years ago or even 5. That's the big thing there. And that's why you're seeing a lot of theaters going to comfortable seating and recliners and that sort of thing. They're trying to give people a reason to leave their recliners at home to come to the recliners in the movie theater. So there is a bit of a concern for theater owners that business is going down. Now you also have the on-demand question with The Interview doing so well on demand. Are we going to see more bigger movies, middling and smaller movies from the major studios going on demand? That's the thing that theaters got to be concerned about. There's a couple more news stories, but I we don't have time for that stuff. We got to move on. You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Was I correct? Last week I said $25 million for The Hobbit. I was actually pretty doggone close. The Woman in Black was not a big juggernaut of box office potential. It did okay. It did okay for what a sequel to a movie that didn't star Harry Potter but had Daniel Radcliffe is without anybody of note at the level of Daniel Radcliffe. Woman in Black 2, Angel of Death, actually came in fourth over the weekend with $15 million, which was not bad for what it, I mean, for the kind of movie it was and the lack of star power. $15 million is not bad. But it came in under Into the Woods and Unbroken, which were both hovering around 18, 19 million. And then The Hobbit was at 22 million. So I was pretty close. I said 25, so it's a little bit slower. But The Hobbit's still a massive hit. It's over 700 million worldwide. I don't know if it's going to break $1 billion, but it could. And it's definitely a moneymaker for Warner Brothers. This week, I'm going to say Taken 3 is going to make about $30 million. I think that's good for it simply because it's a franchise. You know what you're going to get, and people tend to like Liam Neeson kicking butt. Even though this is very derivative of the other movies, it's known quantity. And it's also very different than the other movie. It's very different than Inherent Vice and Selma, which are also opening wide. And there's no competition from last week because Angel of Death is going to completely plummet. So I think $30 million for Taken, but Selma, I think, is going to give it a run for its money. I think you're going to see in the mid to high 20s for Selma. I think Selma is going to be a massive hit just because it's timed so well, and it's a good movie. And it's going to get good word of mouth. It's got good critical consensus. I think it's one of those movies that's going to do well. You're listening to Fat Guys of the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the world-famous DVD roundup. First movie on the list is Boyhood. I neglected to put that in the stinker, even though I did not like that movie. Everybody else. Is everyone saying that that's going to win the Oscar? It's not. Selma has a better chance of winning the Oscar, and I'll explain my Oscar analysis later. Let's wait for the nominees of the Oscars before I start claiming who's going to win something. But Boyhood, it's an interesting film experiment that was kind of ruined by Richard Linklater's standard depressing style and outlook on the human psyche. But it's an interesting movie to see. It's the talked about movie of this year. It's this year's Human Centipede. Boyhood is this year's Human Centipede. Get On Up is the story of Chadwick Boseman playing James Brown, which actually was a really good movie. And I thought Chadwick Boseman did a great job. I think he got a little bit snubbed for award season. You're not seeing him show up much, but mainly because this movie failed to make a huge splash. And that's kind of a shame because it's a good movie. It's worth checking out, especially if you're at all a James Brown fan or a fan of his music, it's a well-done movie. It's a well-done biopic that works and actually manages to do things in a somewhat unique way. There's also No Good Deed, which stars Idris Elba, non-James Bond Idris Elba, as a man terrorizing Taraji P. Henson at home. Home invasion thriller. The Guest, another home invasion thriller by Adam Wingard. Dinosaur 13, which is a really interesting documentary about the discovery and legal battle that ensued for the dinosaur skeleton of Sue, the T-Rex that's almost nearly complete. And it's heartbreaking to watch, but it's also a pretty interesting movie. It's definitely worth checking out. One of the better documentaries I saw in 2014. Then from TV, you've got Girls Season 3, which I'm not a big fan of. And, you know, I've been over my thoughts about Lena Dunham. But people tend to like that. It's on HBO. Season 3 is available. And then Archer Season 5. Archer's a hilarious show, animated on FX, about a spy group. And it's just, it's ribald, it's silly, it's obnoxious, it's crazy, it's offensive. It's a good show. Check it out. Archer Season 5. The Stinker of the Week is Left Behind with Nicolas Cage. Why? Because it's a terrible movie and the most boring version of the Rapture I've ever seen. It was just terrible. Made my top 10 worst movies of the year. Made some people's number one worst movie of the year. So avoid that. Left Behind, leave that one behind. That's it on the DVD rundown. I wanted to remind you once again to watch the Critics' Choice Movie Awards January 15th at 9 p.m. on A&E. Next week, we're going to be talking about Black Hat, which stars Chris Hemsworth. And if there is not a scene of him wearing a black hat, I am going to be mad. Paddington, which is about a bear wearing a hat. The Wedding Ringer and American Sniper. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.